Court. The next case is 2012-. Procedurally, can you gentlemen tell me how you're doing this? 5-5-5, are you intending to cover every same issues, or did you divide up the issues so that you'll each be addressing a discrete part of this case?
Well, Your Honor, we intend to address the issues raised in the briefs filed on behalf of our client, Rackman Shoes.
Well, two of them are the same in terms of the totes issue and the in-bank thing, and one of them continues to argue the totes issue. Apart from that, they're all the same as far as I can tell. So are you just planning on being repetitive, 5-5-5? Is that your...
Hoping not.
Well, that's what I'm hoping not to. But I'm going to put 5 minutes on your clock, and so when your 5 minutes is up, your time is up. But you know, you've asked for 5-5-5, and you've reserved none of you any rebuttal time. Are you aware of that?
Yes.
All right. Just I'm looking for a knowing waiver. That's what I'm looking for.
Hopefully, we can rely on your statement. What are you arguing on behalf of all the parties?
No. I'm arguing on behalf of Rackman Shoes.
Just Rackman.
All righty. It's at your peril. Go ahead.
So will we be hearing from Skids Imports?
I believe
so. I represent Burke.
Yeah.
Your Honor, this case involves the sufficiency of three pleadings. I speak for Rackroom. And the question here is, does Rackroom's amended complaint contain sufficient factual allegations which, if taken as true, plausibly allege congressional intent to discriminate in tariff setting on the basis of gender and age? If so, we nudge our claims across the line from conceivable to plausible, which was required by the Supreme Court's Bell Atlantic versus Quambley and Ashcroft v. Iqbal decisions. But let me first say that this case is different from the Coates Isotoner case the court heard in 2010.
You were counsel on Coates, weren't you?
I was, and the complaint in that...
Why don't you just tell us where the daylight is, because if you had just copied the Coates complaint, you wouldn't be here, right?
I wouldn't be here.
You wouldn't be here. So your complaint is different from Coates.
Yes.
In a couple of aspects, right?
Yes. Well, the Coates complaint was drafted and filed prior to the Twombly decision. It alleged intent in a conclusory manner. The Court of International Trade said
put me on paragraph 31 in count 1 in your amended First Amendment complaint is different from your Totes complaint.
Well, what is different from the Totes complaint, I believe, is in 21, where we allege that Congress had and had available to it and rejected available...
I thought it was 31 where you said have other non-gender factors.
Okay.
Is it 21 or 31?
It's 31. It's in the count, and 21. I'm sorry, 23 that we talk about the choices available to Congress. Now, in Totes, the CIT said, well, if these were facially discriminatory provisions, that pleading would have been sufficient. An appeal to this court ensued on the question of whether it was facial. This court said the provisions were not facial.
Yeah.
Now, on this appeal, Rackroom accepts that the provisions are not facial. This court in Totes said, you got to give us something more than a mere allegation. What we've given the court is something more is the fact...
And the question is whether that raises you from possibility to plausibility. Right?
Well, Your Honor, what we've alleged is the availability and rejection of other non-discriminatory ways to levy a tax or set a trade policy. Now...
Composition of materials, weight of materials, size, etc., right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I'm reading from 23.
Yeah.
And you have to be specific, because you know that's the whole deal here, is are you specific enough to get yourself out of Totes?
Well, absolutely, but the tariff allows for setting rates based on weight, material, all sorts of ways that don't implicate constitutional or equal protection concerns. Congress didn't do that here. Now, in Commerce Clause jurisprudence, the Supreme Court has said...
Does that really make sense to have, you know, have the T-shirt dutied by how much it weighs?
There are plenty of things that are subject to duty based on weight or based on value or based on the materials used. And none of those things would implicate a constitutional concern. It's only when you come down to say, I've got a cotton t-shirt for man and a cotton t-shirt for woman and there's different rates of duty, that you have to ask a question under the Equal Protection Clause.
But how is that just that where you denote within a subheading gender? How does that show or indicate discrimination? discriminatory treatment?
Well, first of all, because the discrimination is based on no factor at that point other than gender. That's very important. We're not talking about, you know, a difference between a tuxedo and an evening gown. We're only talking about products that have all the same characteristics and are differentiated only by the gender.
Okay, so then let's say I buy that. Then we move on to the intent. Where's the intent?
Well, the intent is, first of all, Supreme Court has said that, you know, legislatures, and we're looking to determine the intent of a legislature, which is a collective body, they're often not going to reveal manifest discriminatory intent. But in the Commerce Clause cases, what the courts have said is you can look at the fact that they had available and rejected legitimate non-discriminatory alternatives, which Congress did here. Now, obviously the Commerce Clause and Equal Protection Clause look at different interests, and offensive laws are judged on different standards. But what we're talking about here now is just intent. It's a question of fact. And if the failure to use the legitimate alternatives is sufficient circumstantial evidence of intent, as the Supreme Court said in the Commerce Clause cases, well then as a factual matter, it's certainly enough to get us across the Iqbal versus Twombly line in a Commerce Clause case.
What about the arguments that your opponent makes that there's other reasons why Congress would base a tariff classification on gender?
We see no reason. We see no justification. Should we get the case underway, that would be
about
the government's
burden.
How about
negotiations with countries or setting boundaries or the reciprocal nature of some tariff negotiations, say under the WTO or under NAFTA?
That's interesting background, but it has nothing to do with legislation. The president can negotiate in an extra-constitutional international framework. The Equal Protection Clause is only implicated when Congress takes the result of that negotiation and enacts it as a law. And if that law discriminates against the protected interest, it's subject to review.
What if Congress, for example, in the SSA, in the Statement of Administrative Action, Congress typically will say they accept, they incorporate, they adopt the negotiating objectives of the executive branch? Aren't they also taking into account the purpose of the use of gender?
Absolutely, but all of that has to stop at the waterline of the Constitution. Otherwise, you would get into the argument the government suggests, which is a very dangerous one, which is to suggest that if a law is preceded by international negotiations, Congress can dispose of important constitutional guarantees.
Okay, you're way over your time. Mr. Cohn, you're going to have to touch, you know, and take over for him. Pass the baton.
I will pass the baton.
There you go.
May it please the court, we know from Bray v. Alexandria that an intent to disfavor a class can be readily presumed by the classification of a tax. A tax on wearing yarmulkes is a tax on Jews. We know from Totes that a tax on men's gloves also impacts men directly. So the issue before the court today is not where is the light for us in light of Totes, but where is the light for equal protection in the tariff arena? Because if we look back at the cases...
aren't you basically arguing that we need to overrule Totes?
I am.
I know, but we can't do that. So what?
Well, I asked for on-bank review, Your Honor. And
yeah,
I didn't receive it.
We can't give you that.
Okay. So,
you basically can trot out your in-bank petition to us and have us listen to it if you want, but we're going to deny it.
No, Your Honor. I'd like to rest on the briefs, and we did follow Rule 35 when we made that request, but I understand that Totes is existing. But there is no room left in light of Totes and Rack Room for the Equal Protection Clause from a functional perspective. I've spent a lot of time thinking about this case and been wondering what would we need to show to survive a motion to dismiss. What more do we need than an explicit reference to a suspect class like women or men and a different rate of duty?
What about a general note or a note of interpretation to the HTS that says something like a higher duty on men's glove is designated because men make disproportionately more money than women do?
Right. Well, we know, I think, from a number of... That, of course, would be clearly violative because... Those type of stereotypes are certainly violative of equal protection.
But that type of language doesn't exist.
It doesn't, Your Honor. And the problem is that type of language, if it exists, would be contained in confidential government documents. that we have no access to.
Yeah, but here the duty for men is less than the duty for all the other people. So.
And Your Honor, that exposes the greatest weakness in our case. Sometimes duties favor men, and sometimes they favor women's goods. But we know from the Second Circuit decision in Manufacturers Hanover, where they're not all prejudicing one gender versus another, but that's an issue for summary judgment. That's an issue for the merits. That's not a reason to kick us out of court, as Totes has done. So that's part of our weakness, but you can see from that analogy, or the analogy I'll give you, which is
going back to Judge Moore's question, I mean, we need you to show discriminatory intent. And if the HTS has a high duty on gloves, higher than for other genders, and then further down it switches, and now it's got a lesser duty, where's the discriminatory intent?
Well, Your Honor, the discriminatory intent can be presumed from the use of the class and a different rate of duty. The Supreme Court has instructed this court that a tax on wearing yarmulkes is a tax on Jews. Now, if we had an import tax that was 100% on yarmulkes and 50% on head caps used by Muslims and duty-free for Catholics, it would be the same idea. Then intent to disfavor a class could be presumed. It's the same issue, except that it's intermediate scrutiny.
Now, the statement that you keep referring to, that's dicta, wasn't it?
Pardon me?
In case, the statement about the yarmulkes, that was just dicta.
It was dicta, but this court does not read dicta into nullity when it's been issued by the Supreme Court. And I don't think that the Supreme Court makes pronouncements like that without intention. We have stultified so far in the customs court cases that have come before us, equal protection in the tariff arena. And if we don't find a little bit of light for it, I think it will be a sad day for this court.
Are you arguing for Skids as well? Did I get that right?
Yes, Skids is my client.
All right. Let me ask you a question just real quickly on that. Now, in Toast, this court found third-party standing.
Yes.
And in order to have third-party standing, a litigant has to have a close relation to the third party whose rights are being asserted.
Yes, sir.
I understand that Skids was formed for this litigation.
Correct.
You weren't a party in Toast.
Pardon me?
You were not a party in
Correct. Toast.
And I presume you made a test importation in order to
I did. I made an entry. Correct.
Has Skits sold any products?
No, Your Honor.
Well, where is your connection then? Where's your relationship to a third party in this case?
Well, we have first party standing, Your Honor. And we know from... But
are you arguing here you got first party standing? We said that... That standing existed under third-party standing, not
correct.
First.
Correct, Your Honor. And we're arguing for both first and third-party standing. And if you look at the brief...
address a third-party standing then, and what's your close relationship to the customers? If you, as an importer, with one importation, have not made any sales...
Your Honor, if you would refer to the brief in Sullivan v. Little Hunting Park... where there was a white person who brought a claim, went all the way up to the Supreme Court. There was a restrictive covenant. When he attempted to sell an interest in the apartment or to the sports and the pool, he was sanctioned by the community where he lived.
But he made an attempt to sell. I mean, here there's no attempt.
There is no attempt to sell,
Your Honor.
You don't
have customers. You're not really an importer. I mean,
Your Honor, if I may, we know from the decision in Arlington Heights, the Supreme Court's decision in Arlington Heights, even if one plaintiff doesn't have standing, at the stage of motion to dismiss, it does not matter if one plaintiff lacks standing. So you can address all these issues, and if we get to the merits on this, you can...
Well, is there any question that you don't have first-party standing?
I believe we have first-party standing. Both
you paid the duty, right?
Pardon me?
You paid the
duty, Your Honor. Paid higher duties.
You've been hurt by paying
Correct.
The duty.
That's right. We have an injury in fact.
Mr. Pike now.
Thank you.
Okay. Forever 21, right?
Yes, sir. Good morning, and may it please the court. I was not a party to the Totes litigation, so I guess I'm approaching this from perhaps a fresh perspective, but I'd like to sort of find the light that you articulated earlier. There are two things that the Court of International Trade did not address in its decision. Number one was the context of that case, and number two was common sense. If you look at the Twombly standard, because that's what this whole case is based on, our failure to state a claim, or our alleged failure to state a claim, it really rests on Twombly. Twombly was decided in a specific context. The Supreme Court was, that case involved antitrust matters, and there was a potential for abusive litigation which was specifically cited by the Supreme Court.
It's migrated even to patent law.
And it might even apply to patent law.
It's migrating everywhere.
Right. So this is a standard.
Creeping like a stain.
That's exactly right, and that's why this court needs to address it. I'm not asking the court to overturn Totes. What I'm asking the court to do is to reverse the Court of International Trade with instructions that the Court of International Trade needs to articulate the context in which the case was decided. The context of a tariff case is much different. And one of the things that the Supreme Court articulated in Twombly was that it did not do away with the notice pleading standard of Rule 8. And that's really all that's required here is a short and plain statement of the facts that puts the defendant on notice that there's an intentional discrimination here in the setting of duty rates based on discriminatory gender or age-based classes. That's all that's required. Twombly didn't change that. Twombly only articulated a new standard because of the particular context of that case. And in alleging the facts that we have alleged, which included, by the way, specific evidence that in prior tariffs, the government did discriminate. There were woolens involved, which were intended to be imported at a lower duty rate to promote the slave trade.
I guess,
we had a
counsel,
tariff commission.
I think even under Twombly, the obligation is to plead sufficient facts. And we're here to see if the facts that have been pled are sufficient or not.
Mm-hmm.
And the daylight that's been talked about has been the intent. I think after Totes, that's what was needed in order to get over the hurdle.
Correct.
The intent. Where's the intent?
The intent.
Where have you pled sufficient intent?
The intent has been shown by the facts that were pled and the additional information that was submitted to raise a plausible claim that perhaps the government did intend to discriminate. I'd like to quote from Justice Souter's dissent in Ashcroft versus Iqbal. This is exactly what this case is about. Twombly does not require a court at the motion to dismiss stage to consider whether the factual allegations are probably true. We made it clear, on the contrary, that a court must take the allegations as true, no matter how skeptical the court may be. The sole exception to this rule lies with allegations that are sufficiently fantastic to defy reality as we know it. Claims about little green men, or plaintiff's recent trip to Pluto, or experiences in time travel. That is not what we have here. Similarly, that is not what we have in this case. We have a well-pled...
Tell me, what are the facts? What are the new facts that you've pled?
We had included an affidavit, first of all, from our officer of the Forever 21, showing that men's and women's apparel move in the same channels of trade. Thus, there could be discriminatory impact based on that fact.
That's impact. I think, if I'm right, Judge Reyna is trying to get you to focus on intent because that's your hurdle after...
We pled the intent, but we're not required to prove our prima facie case at the pleading stage.
No, but don't you have to offer something that would suggest intent apart from the facial appearance? Because facial appearance was rejected in Totes, so that can't fill in for you an absence of intent.
And we requested after Totes, you come back, you're going to have to come back with intent. And we're not here to adjudicate the intent, just to see if you pled sufficient facts to support a claim.
We did, Your Honor, and the fact is, if you look at the Kallik case, and this is where the whole plausibility standard has been criticized, the chief criticism that plaintiffs will need discovery before they can satisfy plausibility requirements when there's asymmetry of information with the defendants having all the evidence.
Forget the law.
We pled all that we
could. I think I'm trying to get you to focus on just tell me verbally, what is your plausible reason or intent to discriminate against men or against women on the over-ankle shoes?
What is the
plausible reason?
In the past, there is evidence that the government has used the tariff to discriminate against classes of people based on gender and race.
And this is
that
the
evidence
explanatory
is,
note? Is that what...
Well, that was
I
the tariff
the same
commission.
Question I asked the first guy that got up. If you take your complaint and you lay it up against the Totes complaint, because that's what I did, because you got to get past Totes. There's got to be clear daylight between you and Totes. So which paragraph of your complaint separates you from Totes?
The paragraph...
A lot of the paragraphs are the same. Have you got the complaint?
I don't, and I'm out of time. I don't have the complaint. But the whole issue here is whether the Twombly standard was properly applied.
When the question is whether or not your complaint can be distinguished from Totes complaint, you ought to bring your complaint to argument.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
So we can talk about
counsel, before you sit down, I just want to give you another shot here because this is really important. Now, you said that you have an affidavit and you point us to historical discriminatory activity by the government in the HTS, and those are dated back to the beginning of the 20th century or thereabouts, correct?
Correct.
And since that time, the HTS has gone tremendous change, hasn't it? In fact, it...
To keep up with changes in technology.
What used to be the HTS became the U.S. HTS, and the harmonized system came into being, and we acceded to the World Custom Organization, and different reasons for... governmental reasons for why the U.S. has adopted the HTS in its current form have taken place. But you don't cite any modern type facts, do you? Or do you have something for us to look at?
We attempted to get those facts, Your Honor. I filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, and I asked to have them produce documents, more modern type documents that would support what you're talking about, specifically with reference to from the transition to the from the TUSA to the HTS. As I stated in my reply brief, I was told that, number one, I had to tell the government exactly what document it was I was looking for before they could give it to me. Now, what kind of a standard is that?
So,
Number two...
But without any other evidence, I mean, isn't the HTS full of discrimination? I mean, it discriminates against whether you take high fructose syrup with your cereal or refined sugar, whether you have green tomatoes or red tomatoes or white harvested vegetables from Canada. I mean, it's full of discrimination. The HTS is totally discriminatory on its face in that regard, isn't it?
It's full of distinctions based on various technical specifications, but in terms of gender and age-based discrimination, it can't run afoul of the Constitution. And in order to gather the facts necessary to proceed, we were shut out when we filed our FOIA request.
Thank you, Mr.
Pike.
Ms. Davidson.
May it please the Court. This Court in Totes foreclosed the possibility of making a facial challenge to the tariff schedules based upon equal protection. Yet that is essentially what the appellants have done. Two of the appellants in candor have asked for en banc review, acknowledging that they cannot make an equal protection case unless Totes is reversed. Rec Room does not seek en banc review, but it basically makes a facial challenge because its only evidence of discriminatory intent is the face of the tariff schedule and the idea that Congress didn't have to have those tariff schedules. It could have done something else. But the appellants collectively or individually have not presented any evidence of discrimination.
It seems to me that the data points that are different, because if you take Toad's complaint and line it up against the others, Rack Room has got the argument that Congress had alternative means. Okay? They derive that out of some Commerce Clause cases. They admit that, but they still think it's pertinent to intent. They claim it is. The other two have an affidavit and they've got some historical documents. It would be helpful for me if you simply would take them front on and explain why, on the intent prong, the fact that Congress could have done it a different way is irrelevant, and then the other pieces.
Yes, Your Honor. This court in Totes held that the differences in the tariffs apply to the products themselves or to the users. As applied to the products, then you're into a rational basis test because it's a tax on property, like the coal case. And those attacks on products can be relevant to an equal protection claim, but it's a rational basis test. So if you look at a rational basis test, then the fact that there were other alternatives does not mean that the alternative that the government chose was irrational. And here, there are the appellants concede that the main purpose of tariffs is to raise revenue. They concede that there have been negotiations over many years with over 100 of our trading partners, which have led to differences in tariff categories. So there clearly is a rational basis for the government. The fact that the government could have decided to do something else doesn't mean that what the government did do is irrational.
I think your opponents argue that this is not a tax or, let's say, a discriminatory treatment on products. It's on people. People bear the price of the higher rate. And in this case, for men's gloves, it's either a lower rate or it can be a higher rate. That's the discriminatory treatment. And in fact, in Totes, we bought that, didn't we? I mean, we said you have third-party standing because we recognize that it's individuals that are involved here.
The court said in Totes the only way conceivably someone could make out an equal protection claim based upon the tariff schedules is if they could show that a user of the imported goods was being disparately affected, that women were being affected differently from men or men differently from women.
Just take, for example, a t-shirt, a common cotton t-shirt, and the material is exactly the same, and even the only difference is possibly size. And for some women's t-shirts, it's the same extra large as it is for the gentleman. So that's, and then we're going to talk about you. I think did a good job on products saying there's a rational basis. What happens when we get to users?
Right. Okay. First let me just say that unisex clothing falls into other. So if you have a product like a t-shirt that there may be unisex t-shirts that aren't really specifically for men or women.
It may fall in, but my hypothetical, just saying to you, is there's got a woman who's exactly my size and she's going to buy a t-shirt and she wants exactly the same t-shirt.
But she doesn't want to suffer to pay
a jacked up price because of a higher duty, right? Because it was brought in as a woman's t-shirt.
When there are articles of clothing like shirts, where there are women's shirts, there are men's shirts, even the affidavits attached to the plaintiff's complaint show that those are sold differently. They're sold in different stores or different departments of stores. They are advertised in different media. So they are not the same product. Certainly a man cannot wear children's shoes.
Veering away from where you were earlier, you said, well, we're going to look at products, we're going to look at users. Products, you use rational basis. There are lots of other reasons why. Take users and analyze that. What's the test?
The only allegation in the complaints that remotely even addresses users or purchasers is the conclusory allegation that these differences in the tariff schedules burden importers, retail, merchandisers, and users. That's a conclusory statement. There are no facts to support it. And indeed, the articles cited in the briefs support the government's position. For example, the article cited in the reply briefs from the New York Times and Claire say, quote, retailers as saying, well, there's a different duty on men's sneakers and women's sneakers, but I charge the same price in my store. So the evidence they submitted shows that any difference in tariff is not always, at least in that one example that they submitted, passed through to the consumer. And that's what they would have to show, a disparate impact under this court's decision in Totes on the users.
No, they don't have to show that it's always true. They just have to make a plausible claim.
No, but they have the data. They say the government has the data about disparate impacts, but they know who their customers are. Forever 21 and Rackroom have customers. They have not submitted any evidence that any one of their customers claims that they are adversely affected by differences in tariff rates. The page from the ITC report that they attached to their brief, it says there may not be an economic reason anymore for this difference in, I think it was slippers, between indoor slippers and outdoor slippers, which are used by different genders. But then it goes on to explain the reasons why they had those differences in the past. And now it has changed. Now we have a very strong slipper producer industry, and the imports are down, and in fact use is down. So maybe there isn't an economic reason to keep the tariff, but there's no indication that the economic reason was a subterfuge for gender, or that there was an intent to make women pay more or men pay more or less.
One of the things that, see, from a facial standpoint, I think help you is that while the tariff, the HTS-US may be discriminatory, it's sort of discriminating all over the place, you know, the Totes contrasting with this, and in Totes, men's gloves were taxed more highly, and here it's women's shoes that are taxed more highly. And so would it be different? Would this possibly be a different case if they were able to demonstrate that throughout the entire HTS-US, every single time men have to pay more? I mean, because wouldn't that sort of create an implication of an intent? Wouldn't that, because that's what they're missing.
I think that
this
that,
is all about intent.
That might be an easier case for them. They scoff at the fact that the differences net out and that you know, sometimes men's products have a higher tariff, women sometimes have a higher tariff. They scoff at that and say two wrongs don't make a right. But what it really shows is that there was no intent to single out, for example, in some of the cases, to make assumptions that about widows versus widowers or men versus women in the treatment, in tax treatment. That here it was solely based on the products, and gender is just used as a descriptor. What they've done is gone through the tariff schedules and picked out every descriptor that uses the word men or women. But there are other descriptors that describe products that are only used by one gender or the other, in fact, but don't use the word men or women. And they haven't identified those because they are just making a superficial attack based on words, based on nomenclature used in some of the descriptions of the tariff categories.
Well, while they may not have proffered an adequate amount to survive, say, a summary judgment motion or maybe prevail on the issue of intent, I mean, this is only plausibility. They only have to allege enough to meet the plausibility standard at this point in the proceedings. And why haven't they at least raised a plausible claim at this point?
Well, they haven't alleged any fact that would satisfy the two requirements that this court identified in Totes they would have to satisfy.
Intent.
They haven't
intent? Is
intent
that
and disparate impact. They haven't alleged that any user has been disparately affected, has had to pay more, or has not been able to get products because of the price. And in fact, one of their other attachments to their brief says that retail.
Why do you need that for disparate impact? For disparate impact? Why isn't it enough to show that you're treating the two classes differently?
Because the tax is on products. And the panel, the majority in Totes,
as opposed to the Yamaka case where it was about wearing.
Exactly, Your Honor. And my learned opponents blurred a lot of distinctions by talking about wearing yarmulkes, and Catholics. Those are three different things under equal protection law, and they're analyzed differently. The Supreme Court's comment in Bray was about wearing yarmulkes. It wasn't even about yarmulkes themselves. And just parenthetically, there are no duties on religious articles. Those are exempt. And here, what we're talking about is an economic tax, as the panel said in Totes, which is imposed on a product. And so what you look to see is whether there's a rational basis. And here we've identified a rational basis, which the appellants essentially concede. And then the only thing that they assert is conclusory allegations of law, really, conclusory assertions that there must be discrimination because there's different words used in the tariff schedules, and the possibility that Congress could have done something differently.
What about their argument that there's alternatives, non-discriminatory alternatives that are available to the government?
Under a rational basis test, the fact that there are alternatives doesn't mean that the basis the government chose or the path the government chose was irrational. They're trying to flip the test on its head. I assume that they're making the Dormant Commerce Clause argument to preserve it for the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court's case law analyzes the Dormant Commerce Clause and the Equal Protection Clause very distinctly. And this court couldn't adopt that test for equal protection when the equal protection cases clearly say you must articulate evidence of discrimination. I would also just note that Iqbal does talk about discrimination claims and makes clear that the Twombly standard applies to discrimination claims. The plaintiffs have some upon information and belief assertions, but even those are really upon belief and belief because they don't contain any information. It says upon information and belief the government is discriminating. But that's a conclusion. It's not a fact.
Can I just ask a global question, Ms. Davidson? Your brief tells us that there are at least 160 of these cases in the Carbon National Trade that are proceeding along. Do you know enough about them to know, are there little differences, like there are counsel doesn't think they're little, but there are differences between the complaints in this case and the complaints in Totes. In all those 160 other cases, are there little differences too? So,
well, actually, Your Honor, after Totes, in the Court of International Trade, we proposed and the court adopted a deadline for all of those plaintiffs to amend their complaints if they wanted to in light of Totes, so that they could come forward and now make allegations to satisfy those two criteria. Very, very few of them even filed amended complaints. I mean, Rack Room, to its credit, filed an amended complaint, but almost none of them filed amended complaints. And in fact, it's one of their articles that they attached to their brief, if you look it up, they cite it, it says, many importers and retailers are reluctant to become involved in these equal protection tariff cases for fear of their own gender discriminatory practices being revealed. And what that shows is that there are other reasons in the market that lead to the final price paid by the consumer. It's not, you can't just assume that a difference in the tariff ultimately is reflected in the price paid by the consumer. There are myriad other market forces, including the need to stay in business, competition down the street, consumers' willingness to pay more, and all of those factors would have to be discovered if these cases were to go forward, because the government also would be able to take discovery to see whether the price really does pass through. They have provided no evidence that
it does. A large category of 160 cases are going to be disposed of if there's no in-bank review of totes.
Right. Well, I think this
court, whatever the data points are that come out of these cases, may or may not be useful for the case, for the complaints that were amended.
Well, I think this court in Totes tried to cover the whole waterfront in assuming that Totes had satisfied the requirements for third-party standing and going ahead and identifying what would be necessary for a third-party case, even though Totes actually hadn't really alleged it. And I think this court was trying to resolve all these cases in Totes. But because there were other cases left at the Court of International Trade and Totes was only a test case, we asked if any of them wanted to try to fit within this narrow window that the court identified in Totes, and these were the three that volunteered.
Disparate impact window.
Yes, disparate impact and discriminatory purpose.
Yeah. Thank you, Ms. Davis.
Okay. Thank you very much. For those reasons, we ask that you affirm the
court takes the case under submission. We thank all the counsel.